I should like to welcome Miss Carolyn Kaiser to the Poetry Center and to the campus of San Francisco State. Miss Kaiser is a native of the Pacific Northwest. Her books are The Ungrateful Garden and Knock Upon Silence. She is founder and first editor of the enormously influential magazine Poetry Northwest. She was a poet in residence in Pakistan for the U.S. Department of State in 1965, and she is now director of the literature section of the Humanities Foundation in Washington.
The Art Foundation.
Okay. It's in
I don't know what a humanity is. I have a vague idea what an art is.
Okay. I suppose that there is a temptation which every woman poet in America must resist. That is the temptation to cultivate her own feminine idiosyncrasies and by so doing to become a pale and genteel follower in the tradition of, let's say, Emily Dickinson. Miss Kaiser, I think, has courageously resisted this debilitating temptation. Her work is honest, and her honesty makes it strong, vivid, and arresting. She is a powerful and a personal voice in American poetry. With great pleasure, I give you Carolyn Kaiser.
Well, I can't say how lovely it is to be here and to look around and see so many friends and nice people and beautiful people. I'm very glad I'm here. Thank you for having me. And I want very much to read, if I may, to begin with, some poems by friends of mine that are connected with this place in one way or another, and or connected with my magazine or my life or with the Northwest, which has been my life. I want to read first a couple of poems by Robert Peterson. I published both of these in Poetry Northwest. I want to read one of my very favorite poems, called Jean Gabin as Ship. In this plot, he's a chef, falls for his stepdaughter, loses his best friend for it, etc. There's some killing. Things finally get resolved, and he comes back alone to his kitchen, sadder at the end. But what he thinks isn't important. It's that smooth, well-trimmed walk between the big scenes I go to see. I try it myself sometimes when I have a need to be making not love, but speed with lots of deep water under me. And this is a poem called Bill as Bachelor, Bill as Groom. In the tea garden, while you look for that bell, because it's a bell, or Lenore, or True, I think of Cyrano, who for the pure ways he could speak, strike, and cry, you'd rather be. Hear your bull fiddle heart, see Keaton manning a sleepless train, and send this. Purcell's music is promised if you die first, friend. That goes for me too, incidentally. But screw the bell, Cyrano, was no drummer and not dead, and if I were you, I'd shoot my mother. From formal gardens, you flew through impregnable houses, gasping, love, just a little. Where I live now, dogs of the rich bay at the sun, and even stones are loaned. In a prime pasture at 26, your bride is neat, rubs your back, and bakes. Bougainvillea blooms, good cats slaughter mice, and cows munch through cactus. How do I sit on your front porch predicting disasters? Only this morning the phone rang. It was Mrs. Malatesta wondering where you are. I'd like to read two poems by my dear friend Kenneth Hansen, who at the age of 42 is having his first book published and has just won the Lamont, to the great joy of his friends. I think Kenneth about the closest thing to the Ezra Pound of my generation. I don't know any higher compliment I could pay to anybody. His poems don't give everything on first hearing, unfortunately, but they're wonderful poems, and he's a wonderful man. This one's called Making the Scene, and it's a translation in a loose but wonderfully accurate way of the poem of a poem by Lin Ho Ching, who's a 12th century Chinese poet, Sung poet. One notable critic complains my poems don't deal with the larger issues. I look at Mount Pilchuck in spring under a green rain dripping from the eaves. Well, there are some would pull the gull down for not wanting to be an eagle, and the lizard for changing quick as a wink. From where I sit, new pine shoots glisten over Queen Anne's lace at the foot of the meadow. And one day last week, a guitar-playing scholar stopped by to copy a song from a notebook, anxious to get the set of the words just right. And this one's called, this poem by Kenneth Hansen is called The Distance Anywhere. My neighbor, a lady from Fujian, has rearranged her yard completely. She has cut down the willow tree, burning it piecemeal against a city ordinance, and has put in its place her garden of strange herbs. I confess I resent the diligence her side of the fence, the stink of that oriental spinach she hangs on the clothesline to dry, and the squawk of the chicken I suspect she keeps against the city ordinance shut up in the white garage, eventual soup. But when, across the rows of whatever she grows, she brings her fabulous speech to bear, birds in the trees, the very butterflies unbend, acknowledging to syllables of that exacter scale, she'd make the neighborhood, the unaccustomed air, for all the world to see, sight, sound, and smell, Fujian, beyond our ordinances, clear. Oh, I think I have to read a little poem by Bill Stafford, if I may, William Stafford. Called At the Bomb Testing Site. This is a nice anthology, and I say that not just because I'm in it, but because it is. It's edited by Robin Skelton. It's a kind of selection of one's poems that makes one seem better than one is, in fact. And I don't know as I believe in regionalism, or that I could ever defend it, but I think these five poets belong together and interlock in a comfortable and interesting way, and we all love each other and belong to each other. And I think San Francisco may be the only other place in the world where poets can feel like this about each other. Now that Theodore Retke is gone, I suppose William Stafford is probably the ranking poet in the Northwest, the best poet that we have in the Northwest. At the bomb testing site. At noon in the desert, a panting lizard waited for history, its elbows tense, watching the curve of a particular road as if something might happen. It was looking at something farther off than people could see, an important scene acted in stone for little selves at the flute end of consequence. There was just a continent without much on it, under a sky that never cared less, ready for a change, the elbows waited, the hands gripped hard on the desert. Now I'd like to read a poem by John Logan, if I may. I wanted very much to read a poem by Robert Duncan, very much indeed, but that my friend's well-equipped library had that one missing link in it, something I'll repair this afternoon at the nearest bookstore. I want to read Logan's poem called, I'm sure you've heard him read it, and he reads it so beautifully I shouldn't have the temerity to read it, but I'm going to anyway. It's the perfect poem to read at a poetry reading anyway. It's called To a Young Poet Who Fled, and the epigraph is, Your cries make me afraid, but we love your delicious music, which is from Kierkegaard. So you said you'd go home to work on your father's farm. We've talked of how it is the poet alone can touch with words, but I would touch you with my hand, lost son, to say goodbye again. You left some work and have gone. You don't know what you mean. Oh, not as a son, for I have others, perhaps too many. I cannot answer all the letters. If I seem to brag, I add, I know how to shatter the image of a father. Twice have tried to end the yearning of an orphan son, but opened up in him and in me another wound. No, I say this. You don't know the reason of your gift. It's not the suffering. Others have that. The gift of tears is the hope of saints. Monica again, and Austin. I mean the gift of the structure of a poet's jaw, which makes the mask that's cut out of the flesh of his face a megaphone, as with the goat-clad Greeks, to amplify the light gestures of his soul toward the high stone seats. The magic of the mouth that can melt to tears the rock of hearts. I mean the wand of tongues that charms the exile of listeners into a bond of brothers, breaking down the lines of lead that separate a man from a man and the husbands from their wives in these old burned glass panels of our lives. The poet's tongue has its jaw ripped as Philomel, its lips split and kissed beside the grave, the jawbone patched and cracked with fists, and then with a sob of his fellows. If they make him bellow like a slave, cooked inside the ancient brass bowl, but still that small machine inside its throat makes music for an emperor's guest out of his cries. Thus his curse. The poet cannot weep but with a public and musical grief. And he laughs with the joy of others. Yet when the lean blessings come, they are sweet and great. My son, I could not make your choice. Let me take your hand. I am too old or too young to say. I'd rather be a swineherd in a hut, understood by swine, than be a poet, misunderstood by men. Well, now we come to lovable old me, anti-climax firm. I'd like to begin by reading a poem that's not in my books, because I feel it's an introduction to me. It's called Where I've Been All My Life. You know, that inevitable question that one gets asked, you know, where have you been all my life? Well, this is where I've been all my life. And it was written for an anthology called The Girl in the Black Raincoat, which George Garrett did at the University of Virginia. He had a student who turned in a story about another student, a girl in a class that he had. This girl always wore this black raincoat. She's a very beautiful girl. I've seen the girl. She's very beautiful. And she always wore this black raincoat buttoned all the way up to the throat and the collar turned up. And of course, inevitably, they discovered that, you know, she didn't have anything on underneath. Well, you know, this sort of turned everybody on. And this boy wrote a story about it. And then when George passed this story around among his colleagues, everybody began writing stories and poems about this girl. And so George thought, well, this would make a kind of dumb, nutty anthology. So he sent the copies of some of the work to friends of his, and so we all wrote things about it. And I wrote this poem, and then I read the poem, and I thought, well, this doesn't have anything to do with the announced subject at all. And then I thought, well, yes, it does, because I wrote it in response to this information. So maybe it's the view from inside the raincoat. I don't know, but anyway, here it is. And it's called Where I've Been All My Life, and it's about three cities that have been very important to me in my life. Sir, in our youth, you loved the sight of us. Later, you fall in love with what we've seen, would lose yourselves by living in our lives. I'll spin you tales, play the Arabian girl, working close alone in the blonde arena, flourish my cape, the cloth on the camera, for women learn to be a holy show. I'll tell you where I've been, not what I am. In Rotterdam, womb where my people sprang, I find my face, my father, everywhere. new cousins I must stoop to greet. The get of tall, whey-colored burgers, sturdy dams, as children fed on tulip bulbs and dirt, tugged at dry dugs and sucked on winter's rind. My cousins, dwarfed by war, your forms rebuke the butcher and the bystander alike. To ease you, I can't shrink this big Dutch frame, God of more comfortable ancestors. But from my southern side, I pluck a phrase, I'll carry you, and it means rest in me, to hold you as I may, in my mind's womb. But snap the album, get the guidebook out. Rotterdam, her raw gray waterfront, Zad Keen's memorial burning on the quay. This bronze is mortal, gaping in defeat. The form that wounded split to let it be. It mends, he lurches up in blood reborn, the empty heaven, his immortal frame. Move to my room beside the golden horn, where minarets strike fire against the sky. The architecture, breasts and phalluses. Where are the words to say that words are lies? Yeats lied, and here Byzantium lies dead. Constantinople, syllables in a text. Istanbul, real, embalmed in dancing dust. Everywhere the dark brown past gives way to the beige of progress, that wide, vacant lot. Turkey without coffee. Endlessly we sip tea from bud vases. And I lust for the guide, a sultry, serious, pedantic boy in a tight brown suit, thirsting to get out of the triple city weighing on his mind. Oh, he was doomed, doomed like the dogs on Dog Island in the sea, netted and dumped and exiled, left to die, then skinned. We heard imaginary canine howls, like the rustling of a thousand gauzy girls, film-eyed cattle, perishing of ennui in abandoned harems where he guided me. Meanwhile, the faithful, prostrate and intoning, stare into the light as blind as death, knowing for sure their end is instant heaven. We infidels concede them paradise, having known heaven is harem, a eunuch god in charge, the virgin slowly fattening to blubber, faith become feminized, tickles like a feather. The saints of art, Sophia, that vast barn, hold no small savior waiting to get born. The formal scribble on the assaulted walls, 500 years of crossing out his name. Some famous glittering pebbles mark the place of God's most grandiose sarcophagus. Decay, decay, and the mind, the fetus, dies. Return me to the airfield near Shanghai, where I am very young. Shy, apprehensive, seated like Sheba on a baggage mountain, waiting for the first adventure to begin. The train will glide through fields of rice and men, bodies like thongs and glorious genitals, not alien as Chinese, but Adam strange. Rejoiced by her first look at naked men, her soul swims out the window of the train. She goes where newborn daughters clog the creeks. Bank porticos are strewn with starving rags. Here the old dragon, China, threshes, dying. But the ancient virile music of the race is rising, drenched in gongs and howls of dogs, islanded beside walled-up women dreaming of peasants in their prisoning fields. But we break out of the harem of history. No longer that young foreigner on the train, I listen like a bird, although I ruminate like a cow in my pale Holland body riven by love and children. These eyes are what they see. Come, die with me in the mosques of Rotterdam. Thank you. it's all right with you, I want to read a whole lot of Chinese poems. Is that all right with you? They're from my new book. And in the first section of the book are poems based on classical Chinese models. The first several of the poems are, thank you, Mark, are poems of Bo Chu Yi. The first one is a frivolous number called To Jan and Bar Maria. Though it's true we were young girls when we met, we've been friends for 25 years. But we still swim strongly, run up the hill from the beach without getting too winded. Here we idle in Ischia, a world away from our birthplace, that colorless town, drinking together, sisters of summer. Now we like to have groups of young men around us. We are trivial-hearted. We don't want to die anymore. Remember 15 years ago, in our twin pinafores, we danced on the boards of the ferry dock at Mukilteo, mad as the yearling mares in the full moon. Here in the morning moonlight, we climbed on a workman's cart, and three young men shouting and laughing pulled it up through the streets of the village. It is said we have shocked the people of Forio. They call us Gianna and Carolina, those two mad stranieri. And this is another poem based on a poem of Bo Chu Yi called Singing Aloud. We all have our faults. Mine is trying to write poems. New scenery, someone I like, anything sets me off. I hear my own voice going on like a god or an oracle. That cello tone intuition, that bell note of wisdom. And I can't get rid of the tempting tick of pentameter, of the urge to impose a form on what I don't understand, or that which I have to transform because it's too grim as it is. But age is improving me. Now when I finish a poem, I no longer rush out to impose it on friendly colleagues. I climb through the park to the reservoir, peer down at my own reflection, shake a blossoming branch so I'm covered with petals, each petal a metaphor. By the time we reach middle life, we've all been deserted and robbed. But flowers and grass and animals keep me warm. And I remind myself to become philosophic. We are meant to be stripped down to prepare us for something better. And often I sing aloud. As I grow older, I give way to innocent folly more and more often. The squirrels and rabbits chime in with inaudible voices. I feel sure the birds make an effort to be antiphonal. When I go to the zoo, the primates and I, in communion, hoot at each other or signal with earthy gestures. We must move further out of town, we musical birds and animals, or they'll lock us up like the apes and control us forever. And this is a poem about friendship, I guess. It's to Robert Creeley. It's another poem based on a model of Bo Chu Yi. It's called Amusing Our Daughters. And if I seem too moved by my own poetry, it's not that at all. I'm moved by my friendship with this man. We don't lack people here on the Northwest Coast, but there are people one meets, not people one cares for. So I bundle my daughters into the car and with my brother poets go to visit you, brother. Here come your guests, a swarm of strangers and children, but the strangers write verses. The children are daughters, like yours. We bed down on mattresses, cots, roll up on the floor. Outside, burly old fruit trees in mist and rain, in every room, bundles asleep like larvae. We waken and count our daughters, otherwise nothing happens. You feed them sweet rolls and melon, take them all to the zoo. Patiently, patiently, ever the father, you answer their questions. Later we eat again, drink, listen to poems. Nothing occurs, though we are aware you have three daughters who last year had four. But even death becomes part of our ease. Poems, parenthood, sorrow. All we have learned from these of tenderness holds us together in the middle of life, entertaining daughters by firelight with cake and song. You, my brother, are a good and violent drinker, good at reciting short line and long line poems. In time, we will lose all our daughters, you and I. Be temperate, venerable, content to stay in one place, sending our messages over the mountain and water. This poem is based on a poem by the Emperor Wu Di, which is 2nd century, and very, very now, I think. Never believe I leave you from any desire to go. Never believe I live so far away except from necessity. After a whole day of separation, still your dark fragrance clings to my skin. I carry your letter everywhere. The sash of my dress wraps twice around my waist. I wish it bound the two of us together. Do you know that we both conceal our love because of prior sorrow, superstitious fear? We are two citizens of a savage era, schooled in disguises and in self-command, hiding our aromatic, vulnerable love. This one is called Summer Near the River, and it's based on some themes in the Book of Songs, a much longer work with just a few lines here and a few nippy effects I've stolen here and there. I have carried my pillow to the windowsill and try to sleep with my damp arms crossed upon it, but no breeze stirs the tepid morning, only I stir. Come, tease me a little. With such cold passion, so little teasing play, how long can we endure our life together? No use. I put on your long dressing gown. The untied sash trails over the dusty floor. I kneel by the window, prop up your shaving mirror, and pluck my eyebrows. I don't care if the robe slides open, revealing a crescent of belly, a tan thigh. I can accuse that non-existent breeze. I'm as monogamous as the North Star, but I don't want you to know it. You'd only take advantage. While you are as fickle as spring sunlight, all right, sleep. The cat means more to you than I. I can rouse you, but then you swagger out. I glimpse you from the window, striding towards the river. When you return, reeking of fish and beer, there is salt dew in your hair. Where have you been? Your clothes weren't that wrinkled hours ago when you left. You couldn't have loved someone else after loving me. I sulk and sigh, dawdling by the window. Later, when you hold me in your arms, it seems for a moment the river ceases flowing. Well, that's enough of that, I expect. I'll read one poem from my first book for Robert Peterson, because he always liked it, and we began to be friends when he wrote me a fan letter about this poem. He heard somebody read it over KPFA. Did I read it? No, I read it. Well, I don't know. One never knows. It's called The Great Blue Heron. It's a poem to my mother. As I wandered on the beach, I saw the heron standing, sunk in tattered wings he wore as a hunchback's coat. Shadow without a shadow, hung on invisible wires from the top of a canvas day. What scissors cut him out? Superimposed on a poster of summer by the strand of a long decayed resort, poised in the dusty light, some 15 summers ago, I wondered, an empty child, heron, whose ghost are you? I stood on the beach alone in the sudden chill of the burned,
My thought raced up the path. Pursuing it, I ran to my mother in the house and led her to the scene, but the spectral bird was gone. Her quick eye saw him drifting over the highest pines on vast, unmoving wings. Could they be those ashen things, so grounded, unwieldy, ragged, a pair of broken arms that were not meant for flight? In the middle of my loss, I realized she knew, my mother knew, what he was. Oh, great blue heron, now that the summer house is burned, so many rockets ago, so many smokes and fires and beach lights and water glow, reflecting pinwheel and flare, the old logs hauled away, the pines and driftwood cleared from that bare strip of shore where dozens of children play. Now there is only you, heavy upon my eye. Why have you followed me here, heavy and far away? You have stood there patiently for 15 summers and snows, denser than my repose, bleaker than any dream, waiting upon the day when, like gray smoke, a vapor drifting into the sky, a handful of paper ashes, my mother would drift away. Can you stand one long Chinese poem? It's a translation of Du Fu, which I like very much to read. Some of these poems aren't poems I feel that I can read to the average audience. I feel that I can only read it to an audience like this one, that cares about Oriental poetry and knows about it and has some relation to the Orient and understands what it's all about. I'd like to read this poem. Is called A Visit in Winter, and it's a poem really against Taoism, and because Du Fu thought, well, if we're all going to live forever, what's the point of any of it? You know, why struggle? So he didn't believe in it at all. And the only other translation of this poem that I know of is by a very fine Chinese scholar, but he always translates a character with one word, and sometimes I don't think you can do that. At the end of this poem, it says something. He had, if we are deathless, how then can clumsiness be maintained? You know, which is kind of marvelous, but I don't really think it tells you exactly what the poet had in mind. The character, which he translated as clumsiness, was pretty complicated, so I translated it differently, as you'll see in the last line. I suppose this man was the greatest poet who ever lived, or at least one of them. He's in the heavyweight Shakespeare Dante class anyway, and of course Kenneth Rexroth has done some beautiful translations of some of them. I don't think this one's been translated into verse before, not as far as I know. Pole star and northern capital, equal as scepter and orb, fences march up the hill like troops protecting the city. The officer priests are severe, the guards grim and cautious. The sky of early winter, celadon, not ice blue, matches the roof tiles which repel the cold. Sound of a slap, war between tiles and the weather. All things come together. In the yard, the gilded tower celebrates oneness. Doors painted with mountains and rivers merge with the true landscape which supports them. Artifice, to concoct realities, reorder the minute universe. These roof beams carved with infinite skill so that the sun and moon revolve around this place. The deathless plum tree has tenacious roots, strong as the scent of orchids, sturdy as dynasties. The victim of history, our emperor, master of virtue. When we toll the names of the great painters, begin with Wu, who moved whole countrysides into this room, nourished gleaming life in a hothouse for heaven and earth. Five learned men in procession like elephants heavy, gray, never breaking their close-linked chain, then an orderly flight of geese, 1,000 pale officials follow them, tame civil servants in dragon robes. The tassels on their ceremonial headgear toss like flames. Wind whips the triangular banners. Great cedars cast their shadows across the temple grounds in dark diagonals. Pears, early gold, blush now from the frost. Hidden by shadows, jade windbells move in the eaves, their music. The naked, frozen, windless on the well, like the silver emperor of Han, immobilized for a while. The spirit thaws as the old beliefs are revived. But is the spirit of man hollow as the note of windbells, or as a great tree ripe for felling? Indeed, if we are deathless, where then is randomness, art's impulse, true disorder? Well, can you stand one more? I don't have to read too long. This poem, I think, is probably one of the greatest poems ever written, one of the half dozen. It's an autobiographical poem, which I think is a genre we should try more often, really. And then first I translated it into couplets. You know, the monosyllabic five-beat line of Chinese is infinitely tedious in English, and you have to think out some kind of equivalent to that discipline, at least. And so I did it in rhymed couplets, and I didn't like that. So then I took out most of the rhyme and did it in quatrains instead. And that, I think, comes pretty close to having some feeling of the original box-like shape of this kind of a poem. Now, he was, of course, a bureaucrat poet, which consoles me in these days, although I doubt that I will write 1,500 poems while I'm in Washington. I've done two so far. But he and Li Po and Bo Chui make it possible to believe that one can work and write in this way. And he held a cabinet post, the equivalent of cabinet post in the emperor's court. He was called a reminder. This was a largely ceremonial title, but he took it far too literally for his own good. He kept reminding the emperor of things he thought he ought to do, so he got exiled to a quite distant province, 2,000 miles away, where he had to maintain life as best he could. But of course, we realize now, very poignantly, the kind of revolution that has been made in travel and space. Of course, all the people who worked at the court left their families behind, sometimes in very distant provinces, and it would sometimes take months, because China was such a vast empire, months for people to communicate or find out what was happening. And of course, in this poem, you'll see this ghastly scene, which I haven't done very well by. I hope I can rewrite it better one day, when he goes home and finds that catastrophe has stricken his family. I also think I should probably say I couldn't have translated this poem without having been a student of Theodore Rettke. I just don't think I could have done it. There's something Rettkean about at least the opening passages of this poem in terms of the relationship to nature. And if it seems faintly reminiscent of Rettke, I don't think this is true of my other poetry, that it's noticeably reminiscent of Rettke at all, but I think in this poem you do sense it, and I think it belongs. I come from Tuling, an unimportant man, only more vulnerable as the years wear on. To serve my country, I've clung to this mad dream without avail, as better men have done. I bowed hardship, whitening my hair, old, already spent at 40. I don't care. When they slam my coffin lid, I shall stay down. Till then, I will persist. I will endure. I mourn for my poor people, laboring, striving all seasons, I rail against their wrongs. Though my cloistered fellow scholars laugh at me, I shall go on pouring out my passionate songs. I must cleave to the center of life, not the edge of a dream. Stay with my brilliant prince deep in the living stream. How could one such as I say goodbye to life forever? Architects, all we need to build a world is here. I have cherished dreams of living by the river, spindrift days in sun without a care. As clover and sunflower lean toward the source of light, I exult in selfhood, assent to my own spirit. Any infinitesimal ant wants its own burrow. Why try to be a whale, prey to great waves or the undertow? Though I learn my own limitations, I can't learn to obey. Leave me here on earth to fail again tomorrow. When I am silent dust, I will persevere. To emulate the hermit in his cell, relinquishing all, I envy his self-control and drink uncontrollably to celebrate his call. I will endure, then thud to earth like a bird. Stricken to the eternal dust, I will persevere. So I soothe myself by pouring out the wine and pouring out my grieved and passionate song. I find the grasses dying with the year. Wind rips open the hedgerows. The thoroughfare from the capital is black where I start out. Midnight at my back, I, perpetual traveler. I cannot tie my coat, the frost is so severe. Intractable buckles and fingers stiff with hoar. The icy sun arises. Troops on the chill frontier gather their spears and banners against the invader. Armies have trampled this ground so many times, crags are worn smooth. But music fills the ravines. I arrive at the mountains of Lee with the morning watch. Beside the sulfur springs is the emperor's coach. A gust of steam smokes in the frigid air. Echoes of bells and drums and resonant cries, soaking voluptuously. In the opaque jasper waters, the imperial ministers loll here, take their ease. The humble and poor are excluded, all their ilk, though they are permitted to weave the pure white silk for the imperial harem. Women full of fear, their husbands flogged by greedy courtiers to extort their exorbitant taxes. Yes, collect the skins of miserable men, that's how you serve your king. Benevolent talents, beware, you will be done in. It isn't enough simply to love your fellow man. What happened to the gold plate on which we used to dine? Now it decks the boards of the emperor's rich hangers-on. But women, like goddesses, move through the corridors, borne on a perfumed wave and swathed in furs. Incense, you will hear the pensive harp and lute, sup on camel-pad broth, and nibble rare winter fruit, frosty oranges and little pungent tangerines that glow in the hand against warm sable sheen. When you've gorged, let the wine sour, food to carry and rot. Fling the meat and drink out of the lacquered gates. Outside, only steps from plenty, men lie down to starve, the courtyards littered with their bones. The span of a woman's arm separates the gilded pillars of the palace from old posts rotten with wind and rain. On the wild roads, the sons of Han lie frozen, and I, the courtier, freeze with unappeasable pain. Between sections of this poem, I might remark that this poet is very popular in China today. I think for obvious reasons he was one of the only poets of his time or of any time who had this kind of social conscience, who cared about what happened to ordinary people. Last section. So my traces turn to the north, where two streams meet. I find the ferry boat moored in another spot. The western skies dump lakes upon the land. Floodwaters rise to meet my outstretched hand. Is this a wet retribution? Will heaven's pillars crack? A myriad river bridges have swept to wrack. One creaking span remains. We travelers crawl across, hand clutching hand. Wide river, hear our curse. In an evil time, I left my wife in a strange house. remote from the court. Now I rejoin my spouse. I'd rather starve at home than feast at court. My beloveds, I have come to share your fate. I open my door to wailing. In anguish and anger, my cries join theirs. My infant son has died of hunger. Even the casual neighbors weep. Why not a father, his guardian, useless and broken, ashamed forever? My own little child has starved, while I wasn't aware that our fine autumn harvest had made no difference here. Dear family, we belong to the privileged class. How then do the poor endure, starved and harassed, their property seized, themselves dragged off in bonds to guard a garrison thousands of miles from home? What of my life, who have never paid a tax, hefted a spear, manned a frontier, beaten a drum? Our land in flood, and my own heart in flood. These frantic thoughts are rising like the waters to flow towards you, wounded, oppressed, bereaved, in desperate love, China, your sons and daughters. Thank you very much.
Rather than having a formal question and answer period, Ms. Kaiser would be glad to talk about anything you want to talk about informally.